Please join me in Acts chapter number 10 as we talk about the great watershed event which brought Gentiles, like so many of us, into the fellowship of the saints. This is where we get grafted into the tree of Israel for the very first time. I already told you the background, that this is taking place somewhere in maybe 38, maybe 39. So we're talking about maybe 5 years or so after the gospel is first introduced to the Jewish people. So we actually see here on the larger scale something that we'll see Paul practice in his ministry, where the gospel is first offered to the Jews, and then later it is opened up to all the other people of the town, the Gentiles, who wish to embrace it. So God has allowed the apostles to focus on Jewish people for a handful of years, and now it's time to bring the rest of the world in on the story. And God chooses to do it through the work of a man who is already partway between those two worlds. He is an Italian man, a centurion, therefore he's a Gentile, but he has started embracing the Jewish faith as his own. He has not yet been circumcised. More than likely, he planned on doing that part of his proselytization once he retired from his Roman soldier duties. That was often the case for those that believed in the God of the Jews while they were Roman soldiers. And so here's his story that we started last session. At Caesarea, which is about 1 day's walk north of Joppa, and we know that that's where Peter is at right now. And Caesarea is the premier man-made harbor on the Judean coast. And it has a lot of traffic coming through it. The majority of the people going in and out of Judea by sea come through this port. So at Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort. He was a devout man who feared God with all his household. So he is a proselyte in process. So we would refer to him as a proselyte at the gate. He's not yet entered fully into Judaism by being circumcised, but he definitely believes in the God of Israel. And he has also brought his family members and his household staff along with him in that belief. He gave alms generously to the people, that's the Jewish people, and he prayed continually to God, which meant that just like other religious Jews, he set aside some time in the middle of the morning and in the middle of the afternoon to pray along with Jews all over the world, but particularly at Jerusalem, during the morning and afternoon sacrifice and incense time. Now, this is very similar, not surprising, since Islam actually borrowed it from Judaism. But this is very similar to how the Islamic people will pause 5 times a day and direct their attention toward Mecca and pray very systematic prayers. Well, the Jewish people had already been doing that during the two times of prayer way back in ancient times. So that's what Cornelius does. And verse number 3 has him doing that in the afternoon. It says, about the 9th hour of the day, so mid-afternoon, we'll just call it 3 o'clock, he saw clearly in a vision an angel of God come in and say to him, Cornelius. So imagine, this man is probably standing in maybe his courtyard, maybe it's in his private chamber, but he's no doubt facing eastward toward Jerusalem. And he's praying probably standard memorized prayers that he's been taught, probably by Pharisees, that go along with this time of prayer. And then suddenly, right there in front of him is an angel of God that speaks his name. So he stared at him in terror and said, "What is it, Lord?" Now, he uses the word Lord here in its generic sense of sir. So he's not thinking that the angel is God. He just knows this angel is a lot more powerful than himself. And so the angel said back to him, "Your prayers and your alms have ascended as a memorial before God." So he is not so much complimented. I think he is told, you don't need to be afraid because God has taken note of your faith demonstrated by your actions. The fact that you're praying on a regular basis and you're giving to those that need. And then he gives him the message that he is supposed to receive. Now, send men to Joppa and bring one Simon who is called Peter. He is lodging with one Simon, a tanner, whose house is by the sea. So he is told specifically to track down this Jewish man that is in a town about one day's walk south from Caesarea. And he's given enough information that Peter can be easily located in the city. Verse 7, when the angel who spoke to him had departed, he called two of his servants and a devout soldier from among those who attended him, and having related everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. So it's now late afternoon, and he grabs two of his non-military servants, guys that work in his household, plus one soldier that is on his staff that also happens to believe the Jewish faith. And he tells them the story about seeing this angel. Now, there's more to the story, by the way. That will come up later. But basically, God said, you're going to get a message from Peter as to how you can be fully saved. So Cornelius shares this information with three others that he knows will respect and appreciate it and actually want to know more about it. And these guys, all three of these other guys, will be Gentiles. Now, the devout soldier is probably also a proselyte at the gate, so he's in the process of becoming Jewish, but we don't know that's the case for the other two, that they might, in fact, just be Gentiles serving in Cornelius's household. But it is interesting that he chooses three, because three is an important number for Peter. It always gets his attention because of the three denials and the three times that Jesus asked him, you know, do you love me? Now, let's shift our attention to the following day. Our three workers for Cornelius probably took off and walked until it got dark and then stopped and spent the night somewhere. It's possible that it might have been a halfway point, someplace near what today is the town of Netanya. I just happen to know that because I've stayed at the hotel at Netanya a few times now. But the next day, they would have gotten up and made the rest of the trip south until they arrived at Simon the Tanner's house. And they'll get there right around noon, which helps us understand this timing. Verse number 9. The next day, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. So it's noon. Now, something that we know about Jewish people from the Old Testament as well is that not only did they pray at mid-morning and mid-afternoon, some of them, like Daniel, would pray at noon as well. In fact, a few would pray at sunrise and sunset as well. So five times a day, pause and turn their attention toward Jerusalem, that is, face Jerusalem, and pray to God briefly, some very specific things, and then they would return to whatever it is that they were doing. This five times a day prayer was lifted out of Judaism by Muhammad, and that is why Islamic people today do the five times of prayer. But that's a side story. Peter's up on the house, flat roofs in the Mediterranean, very common, and it becomes like the patio area. It becomes like the deck of a house in our own culture. It's where you go to kind of be alone and have a cool breeze blowing around you. There would often be like an awning or some sort of lean-to up on the flat roof where you could be out of the sun. So he's up there praying around lunchtime. Verse 10, he became hungry and he wanted something to eat. But while they were preparing it, he fell into a trance. So he goes into a vision state. And he saw the heavens opened and something like a great sheet descending, being let down by its four corners upon the earth. Now, I've often wondered, is this like a great big sailcloth, which Peter had been familiar with from earlier in his life when he was a fisherman? But it's coming down as if it were some sort of bag full of animals, which then once it gets down low enough, it kind of flattens out and Peter can see what's inside of it. Verse 12, in it were all kinds of animals and reptiles and birds of the air. Now, it's important to understand from the language here, from the context here, that these are all non-kosher animals. These are all animals which Jewish people would not eat, according to Old Testament law. God had given them this commandment, at least in part, to teach them to follow instructions. That if God says, this is something you can do, but this is something you can't do, that's all that you needed. I always like to relate it to military basic training. When we went to basic training, we were stripped of all our civilian identity, even our clothing, had to wear, you know, the same uniforms and everything. And we had to all make our beds a very specific way. We had to fold or hang up our clothing in a very specific way. Even our underwear had to be folded in a 6-inch square manner. And if you didn't do it, you got penalized. Now, as soon as basic training was over, we didn't have to do any of that anymore. We didn't have to keep our clothes in exactly a certain order in the drawer, or have them hanging, you know, on hangers separated by, you know, a couple of fingers or something like that. We had already benefited from learning to follow instructions. That was the whole point of it. Once we were matured in that way, we no longer were under that requirement. And so that seems to be the kosher laws, because Peter, through the Gospel of Mark, will actually comment that Jesus had already declared all foods clean when he said that it's not what goes into the mouth that makes a person unclean, but what comes out of the heart through that mouth. So what we're about to see is Peter learning the lesson that kosher is all about what God says kosher is about. Okay? I'll kind of talk about that a little bit more in tomorrow's session. But here we go. It says that there came a voice to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." So he's hungry, and he's told, make yourself some lunch. There was probably a pig there. There may have been some other birds that were unclean birds that Gentiles ate. It would have been a whole big old bunch of food animals that Gentiles ate regularly, which Jews did not. And Peter was just told, you go ahead and make yourself some lunch with this. Now, Peter said, by no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. And he uses language that is pretty much synonymous with our idea of unkosher. Now, it would appear that Peter thought at the beginning here that God was testing his resolve as a Jewish person. But Jesus' response, because that's who's talking here, is this, verse 15. The voice came to him a second time. What God has made clean, do not call common. So if God has declared something is kosher, don't you say that it's unkosher. And so this happened three times. There's our number three for Peter again. Every time it happens, you know that he's paying special attention. And then the thing was taken up at once to heaven. So he did not eat any of the three times the animals that were offered to him. He objected each time, and each time he was told, when God has declared something is not, or that something is completely kosher, regardless of what it might have been in the past, don't you go around saying it isn't kosher. Verse number 17. Now, while Peter was inwardly perplexed as to what the vision that he'd seen might mean, so he's chewing on this mentally up there on the roof, that's when the men who were sent by Cornelius, having made inquiry for Simon's house, stood at the gate. So they've arrived at the door immediately while this vision was taking place for Peter. And so they called out to ask whether or not Simon, who was called Peter, was lodging there. And I always appreciate this part of the story. These men are showing extra special respect for a Jewish household. They are calling out. They're not even touching the door. They're calling out as to whether or not this is the place where Simon the apostle is located. Because if a Gentile enters a Jewish house, touches a Jewish house, interacts with the people, physically interacts with the people in a Jewish house, they basically make it unclean. And the Jewish people have to go through special cleansing ceremonies. So these guys, because of their boss, Cornelius's sensitivity toward all things Jewish, they've been very careful about this. So they're yelling out, "Is this where Peter the Apostle is?" Now, while Peter was pondering the vision, verse number 19 says, the Spirit said to him, so this is the follow-up to the vision, "Behold, three men are looking for you." So there's the number again. "Rise, go down, and accompany them without hesitation, for I have sent them." So the Holy Spirit makes it very plain to Peter, you need to go with these guys. You need to consider them my messengers. And so Peter went down with all that background. You know, he had the vision, followed immediately by the Holy Spirit's message, and then these guys showing up. So Peter went down to the men and he said, "I am the one that you're looking for. What's the reason for your coming?" So he wants to know, and you can kind of picture this taking place out in front of Simon the Tanner's house. They said, "Cornelius, a centurion, an upright and God-fearing man." So basically, they've just described to him a proselyte, "who is well spoken of by the whole Jewish nation." So again, he is a Gentile, but he is a proselyte who is respected by the Jewish community because of his status as a proselyte at the gate. "He was directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and to hear what you have to say." So this is where Peter finds out that he has a mission from God to take the gospel to a Gentile household at Caesarea. And it had to have come as a shock to him. And no doubt, if he hadn't been prepped for it by the vision followed by the words from the Holy Spirit, he would have very much hesitated going on this mission. But that's all changed now because he knows that God is in the middle of this. And so he does something that no doubt shocked the entire household. So he invited them in to be his guests. Now remember what I just told you. The moment they crossed that threshold and came into that house, any Jewish person, any observant Jewish person of this time period would have considered the household ceremonially unclean. And they will, of necessity, by their customs, have to go through ceremonies cleansing the building and even cleansing themselves. But Peter, because he is revered, you know, by Simon the Tanner and everybody else that's in the house, he gets away with inviting these Gentiles inside. And then the next morning, they all leave. The next day, he rose and he went away with them. And some of the brothers from Joppa accompanied him. Now remember, the messengers arrived around midday, and then they will leave apparently around midday the following, because it's only one day's walk up to Caesarea from Joppa, but they won't arrive until 2 days later. And so they apparently have some wrangling going back and forth for a while here at Joppa between Peter and other people in the community of believers until finally Peter tells them, "Well, we're going to go." and I want some of you to come with me to bear witness to what is about to happen. Now, how many does he take with him? We know this later. He takes two sets of three. He takes six men from this congregation of Jewish believers at Joppa with him on this trip, so that there's a total of seven Jews traveling to this Gentile household. So the next day he rose and went away with them. Some of the brothers from Joppa accompanied him. On the following day, they entered Caesarea. It's an overnight walk because of when they left. And they arrive, probably from a late start the following morning. They apparently arrive very close to the 3 o'clock in the afternoon hour, 4 days after Cornelius had his vision. So on the following day, they entered Caesarea. Cornelius was expecting them and had called together his relatives and his close friends. So he's called together not just simply his family, but he's also called everybody that he's associated with to meet in his house. And that means this house is full of Gentiles. I'm sure there might be a few Jewish people that have been invited, but would they have come based on the things we were just talking about? I'm not so sure they would have. They might have come and kind of hung around outside. But this house is predominantly full of Gentiles. And that is how you should picture this story as we move forward with it tomorrow, because we're pretty much out of time today. So I want you to mark your spot right here and maybe read ahead a little bit and appreciate again that this is a watershed event that we're looking at, that Gentiles would never have been welcome into the church without this divine intervention.